Today, we take it totally for granted that the watch landscape is populated by a healthy crop of micro-brands, in addition to all of those big, traditional players. But when Bradley Price started Autodromo back in 2011, this was very much not the case. American enthusiasts were not dreaming up their own watches, quitting their day jobs, and launching collections online. A lot has changed since then, but Autodromo is still around and stronger than ever. I've known Bradley since the early days of Autodromo, and he was even one of the earliest Hodinkee collaborators. Growing a watch brand is no easy task, though, and it's been really interesting watching Bradley take Autodromo from a single collection of automotive gauge-inspired quartz watches to a full-fledged lifestyle brand with watches, accessories, and more. It's sort of a microcosm for what's been happening on the enthusiast side of the watch industry more generally, and in this episode, we get into all of that and more. We talk about the glory days of the Salon QP show in London, the joys of doing things the old-fashioned way, and why, even as someone who knows very little about cars, I still find myself drawn to Autodromo's watches. Plus, there's plenty of nerding out about vintage cars from Bradley and our own Cole Pennington while I sit and listen and try to keep up. These guys really know their stuff. I'm your host, Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week's episode is presented by Zenith Watches. Stay tuned later in the show for a look at how Zenith has continued to use the El Primero as a platform for innovation for the last 50 years. For more, visit zenith-watches.com. Thanks for joining us, Bradley.
Thanks for having me.
Good to see you too, Cole. I know you were out running around at appointments all day.
Yeah. It's good to be here, though.
Yeah, we got some good stuff coming.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect. Bradley, we're doing this, you know, for people who may or may not know you. You're the founder and proprietor of Autodromo.
That's right.
And we're doing this the day after you launched your latest watch.
Yeah, the Corsica Blue dial of the Group B Series 2.
Nice. Can you maybe describe, we have a story about the watch on the site that James wrote, so we'll link that up in the show notes, but can you maybe describe the watch for people?
Sure. I mean, to put it in a nutshell, it's a very light kind of teal blue with pink indexes. And I just thought, you know, we're very focused on motorsport history with everything that I've done in the past and or watch history, whatever, that things usually have a very specific reference point from an automotive standpoint. And I just thought it would be fun to do something where we just step away from that a little bit and just have a fun summer watch that speaks to the kind of 80s vibe that the watch has had from the beginning, because it's obviously an 80s inspired design. And I just wanted to, you know, why don't we just have fun with that and just do a cool dial color that's really speaks to the summer kind of feel.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen a dial quite this color combo before.
Yeah, neither had I. but I mean, it's sort of a pink loom and then you know, just this teal dial. And we'd had a lot of success with the Monoposto Azzurro, which was another light blue dial that we had done. And I felt like people still kind of wanted to see more of those type of light blue dials. It's not the same color that we did before, but I just felt like there was still a lot of interest in that. People really liked that dial.
Nice. One of the things I liked about the launch of this actually has very little to do with the watch itself, which is the art direction you took for the photos you shot, the like campaign behind this. Everything had this like pink and purple light. It was super 80s. It kind of felt like stills from a film instead of like a campaign selling a watch.
I mean, I always try to go for a bit of a film still feel with a lot of the visual collateral that goes with the brand, because I'm really a bit, I wouldn't call myself like, oh, I'm like a cinephile, but I really enjoy movies. I always dreamed of being a director, even though it wasn't something I ever pursued. I was like, you know, a frustrated car designer first, and then probably frustrated film director second.
Okay.
But this kind of checks all those boxes running this company, because I get to design really cool car oriented stuff. And then I also get to art direct all the campaigns that we do. And so with this one, you know, I love the idea of implied narrative. You know, I like when a photo kind of draws you in and you would like to know more about what happened directly before or after it. And rather than just saying, you know, here's a watch on some guy's wrist in a car, which I think is the kind of typical, you know, watch photo, you know, that's so prevalent in the industry, or even worse, the guy with the wrist shot and he's holding the watch next to his face so that it all fits in the ad, which I think should be just banned forever. And nobody should ever be allowed to do that ever again because it's so lame. But I think
watchmakers take note.
Yes, yeah,
that's some solid advice right there.
Yeah,
usually have to pay for that kind of advice.
Yeah, I mean, and even more so, it would save those people money because they wouldn't have to pay high-paid spokespersons to hold the watch next to their face. They could just have anonymous people with watches on their wrist. So anyway, I just really enjoy the idea of implied narrative and how the photography tells the story of the watch. It puts it into a time and place. And all of my designs are really about time and place. And every one of them, you can kind of locate into a historical context, even though they're all new. And some of them are more directly historical than others, but they all have a time and place background story to them.
What I hear you saying, and you know, we've known each other a long time, so I kind of knew this coming into this, but, you know, you're doing so many different things for the brand. You know, when we think of like a big watchmaking company, you know, you have a marketing department and you have a product team and you have a sales team, like you're doing all of this, right?
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. And I have, you know, some good collaborators. You know, first of all, my wife helps me a lot, and she's kind of my editor in a way. She really, I show her everything, I run things by her, and she kind of like is my sounding board.
Shout out to Valeria.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I also have worked with some really great photographers, but I've always done all the art direction myself. And it's something I really enjoy doing. And I think it really, given that we have limited resources, that we're not able to do many shoots per year, it's kind of like a one and done, and then maybe a few, you know, then we have Instagram, of course, but that's more like kind of snapshots of things. But as far as the campaigns, I try to get a really significant or interesting car. And we've gotten some amazing cars over the years that we've been able to access, you know, from a real Lancia 037 Stradale, a real Lancia Delta S4 Group B car. And then lately, you know, we did a Lancia D50 Formula One car, which is basically unobtainium. There's only one real one, and this one is the closest second thing to a real one. It's actually made with the original drivetrain of the car, but they recreated the body. But the car basically don't exist anymore. So we got one of those. We got a real GT40, not a fake one, but a genuine real one with history that we used in our GT campaign. So it's really important for me that the cars, because of our audience and because of my passion for cars, like I always want to have really, really sweet cars that are interesting and significant in our campaigns. And we got a Lamborghini Countach Turbo, Countach, but a Turbo Countach.
Yeah, that's the move.
Which was from Rally Road, which is down on Lafayette Street. They allowed us to shoot in that car. And we did have Phil Collins playing on
I'm
the
glad
stereo.
To hear that.
Yes.
Yeah. Very glad to hear
nice
that.
Detail. Nice touch.
And we set up the lights and everything. So it was really a fun, you know, we created a kind of atmosphere in there, and they have a very cool space. So it's easy to get into.
Do you wear
spirit.
A blazer with the sleeves rolled up?
I mean, that is me in the car. So yes, I was the hand model for that shot.
I was going to ask if that's you.
Yeah, it's actually usually me. And it's challenging to, I know it sounds so stupid to a lot of people that haven't actually done it, but it's very hard to actually be the model and art direct at the same time, because you have to constantly be looking at what the photographer's shooting and also kind of holding your wrist. Whenever you shoot wrist shots, you have to be really precise about the angle exactly that your wrist is in, and you adopt these weird stress positions to try and like make sure the reflections don't wash out or whatever. So you kind of keep going back and forth between holding these positions and then looking at the photography and then going back again. It's annoying, but it, you know, it's just part of what we do. So
what'd you do to kind of get in the Miami Vice mood? What was the
ceremony? Well, I think sitting in a Countach with a white leather interior is a good way to get in the Miami Vice mood. I had the, had a white linen suit on and a powder blue sweater under that. So it was easy to get in the vibe. Right. So
that'll do the trick. Yeah.
Yeah. And then when we had the lighting on then there was this moment where I wasn't planning to put a cigarette in the ad or in the campaign, but then we were sitting there and we were photographing the watch still life on the ashtray lid. There's this big ashtray lid just right in the middle of this white leather transmission tunnel. And I said, man, this really could use a cigarette in the ashtray because it would just add a lot more atmosphere to this shot. And it would really like continue that period feeling and that kind of, cinematic feel that this has.
Yeah.
So I went and bought my first ever pack of cigarettes that I've ever bought because I don't smoke. But I always loved tobacco ads as a kid. Like I was like part of the Joe Camel generation of like,
yeah.
I literally cut all those ads out. I saved them. Like I thought they were the coolest thing.
Not as a smoker. You just
ads. I just thought they were cool. I mean, supposedly they were aimed at kids and I guess that I was their target market and I loved those ads. So I cut all of them out. I had all of them like saved. And they were really cool to me as a kid. But I never took up smoking ever. But anyway, it just kind of like, I wanted to kind of remind people of that time period when you would see ads in magazines that had cigarettes in them. And that was kind of like a thing. And that was part of my childhood, reading car magazines and seeing cigarette ads is just kind of, again, I like a certain amount of irony in my work. Like it's not all super serious. So that was kind of the thinking behind it. And I think that it ended up working well in terms of the atmosphere and taking that a step further from just a normal photograph of a watch on a wrist and kind of saying that this is actually a person in a car going somewhere. Maybe he's at a stoplight and he's taking a moment here at the stoplight to like, enjoy his cigarette before he's off to do whatever he's going to do. So that's kind of the stuff I like to do when I'm art directing.
Nice. I mean, you've touched on it a couple of times in kind of light ways, but I want to really dig into it. You started Autodromo because you're a car guy. Like you're an enthusiast who decided to kind of take your passion and make it your business and your life, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I have been a car enthusiast from the cradle, basically.
All right.
My parents have said that they don't know. I mean, my father is a car enthusiast as well, but my brother is not. So it's a mystery as to why it passed to me and not to him.
Yeah.
But I've always loved cars from an extremely young age where I can't even tell you when I saw something that triggered that. But my dad had an Austin Healey when I was little, and I used to just love I think one of the things that I find interesting when you think about your experience of a car as a child, it's on a totally different scale from as an adult. So you walk around a car more in an architectural scale when you're a child. You look straight into the grill, straight into the headlights at eye level. And when the door opens, it's the interior is revealed in the way that a room is. It's not, you don't look down and through the window into the interior. So everything is experienced in a very different way as a child. And I felt like I still have these vivid memories of like when my dad was like washing that car, walking around it and touching the chrome, and it's hot in the sun and you kind of burn your hand on the chrome and the little sparkly bits in the Lucas taillight lens on the Austin Healey as the sun is glinting on it, and just all these little, and the texture of the curly wool carpeting on the transmission tunnel, all those things are like really, really powerful sensory memories for me. So that's just kind of how far back this passion of mine goes. It's just very, it's a very hardwired.
What was the evolution like? I mean, we all have, all car guys, there's the curve that you follow. What was yours?
Well, I mean, I was obsessed with mainly European cars my whole life. I really followed F1 heavily when I was in high school, but then by the time I was out of college, in my early 20s, I kind of went away from it a bit. And I was became more of like a design buff in college. Like I became more, you know, interested in mid-century furniture, collecting furniture. That was also coincided with the time when Apple really had its like rebirth as a design leader. Yeah. So, you know, cause I was in college basically when I was a freshman, like the iMac came out. And then, you know what I'm saying? Like it was like from the colorful plastic era of Apple to the super pure white era. This was before the aluminum era, but the super pure white era was kind of when I graduated. So like, this was like really exciting to be an industrial design student at this time and see that kind of stuff happening. And then also all the things that were going on in the furniture world at the time. So it was like a really cool time around the turn of the millennium to be a designer. And that's why I kind of got really into that and moved away from the cars a bit. Mm. But as I was approaching 30, I kind of felt like a pang of wanting to go back to it a bit. Yeah. So I started.
And you were working as a designer at
the time,
right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I was working as a product designer in Manhattan for.
What kind of stuff were you designing?
So my first job out of school, I was working at the Arnell Group, which is a now defunct branding agency, which actually did some pretty significant work at the time. They created the DKNY brand originally for Donna Karan.
Okay.
Peter created the RBK brand for Reebok. He also, I believe, at least he was credited with bringing Jay-Z in to do the S. Carter stuff, which was the first ever like shoe for a hip hop star, which had never been done before. And I think he was sort of like, hey, like if athletes can have shoes, why can't like a hip hop star have a shoe? And that's like it's usually stop and step back. That's a big freaking deal.
It's huge.
Yeah.
So it was a really cool agency to work at that was doing all this kind of stuff. That the stuff I named is before I was there, but I'm like, when I arrive, it's already kind of like floating on the coattails of those great successes. I was just working in Soho doing a lot of stuff for beverage and food. And we were doing all sorts of crazy concepts of, it was a really fun place to work at the time. It was very stressful, but it was fun because you were really being challenged to think of the craziest things that you could think of, not just like what can be engineered, what could be manufactured, but like, no, what is a Mountain Dew going to be like in 10 years? You know, what kind of crazy things could Mountain Dew be, you know?
And please tell me you designed some Mountain Dew stuff.
I did.
That's amazing.
None of it actually went anywhere, but I had a lot of cool ideas.
Was it 10 years ago?
This was in like 2004.
All right.
Okay.
So yeah.
2005.
And what
I was there 3.5 years. Everything that I worked on there was very, very conceptual. So none of it was really super oriented towards production. Although they did end up doing the Pepsi rebrand, which is not something I worked on because I was an industrial designer, not a graphic designer, but that agency did the current Pepsi logo branding and the ill-fated Tropicana rebrand was also by them.
Okay.
A whole part and parcel thing.
Interesting.
But it was a cool place to work. It was exciting. It was very creative, but draining as well.
Yeah.
So from there, I went to another firm, which was more of like a quote-unquote serious industrial design firm where they did things that you'd actually have to understand how to mold things, how metals formed, et cetera. Like, you know, you actually had to learn and understand production processes. So that was actually really good for me as well. I had some background in that, but to actually deal with engineers on a daily basis and figure out how to produce things was, that was a great challenge. And I learned a lot there. And it certainly, as I began the watch brand, it stood me in a lot of good stead to learn how to deal with factories overseas and how to communicate with them effectively and what things to expect, et cetera.
Yeah.
So that was really a great education.
So you're approaching 30, you're working as an industrial designer, and you have this desire to go back and do something related to cars, but you end up launching a watch brand.
But you also probably did.
There was a one in between step which we're leaving out, which is that I started a website called Automobiliac, which is a blog back in the days when people had blogs.
Yeah.
And it actually had a pretty good following, actually. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't Hodinkee. But
flattery will get you everywhere, man. Everywhere.
But it was of a similar generation as Hodinkee in the sense that it was around the same time as that started. And it was the same thing. It was like a guy who just really into stuff and, you know, wanted to write about what he thought about the industry and, you know, history, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it was in some ways like that, but it just didn't, you know, it was like a hobby, you know, it didn't take off that way. So I was running Automobiliac and I was posting every day or every few days about cars. And it, actually, the site's still up if you want to check it out. I haven't updated it in years, but it's still there.
We're for sure going to link to it. Yeah.
And, you know, it was a way for me to have a way to talk about cars. And I actually met a lot of people who are now friends because of that site. So it was a real great thing for me as a non-car owning New Yorker at the time to kind of be able to reconnect with that passion for cars. After running that site for a couple of years, it kind of overlapped with the beginning of starting Autodromo. And, okay. And Autodromo was basically an idea I had one day. I was driving. So I had an Alfa GTV6. That was the first car that I ever bought when I lived in New York. It was an 83 Alfa GTV6, and it was a fantastic car. And I was driving through Harriman State Park at the time, and I was like, I really love driving, you know, enthusiastically. And I was having just this great day. I was driving through the woods. It was awesome. And I just was looking at the gauges, and I thought, you know, why the hell is there no cool automotive watch that I could afford? Because at the time, you know, that would have been, you know, something that was under $1,000, something that was like even under $500. That wasn't like with flames painted on it.
And, wait, that's not your look?
Not my look. But, right, you know, there was like really like nothing there at the time, like nothing. It was like you either bought, you know, I didn't even know about vintage Hoyer at the time, really, which is probably at the time, the low hanging fruit for like a real automotive watch. But, you know, it was like, either, you know, if you were looking at new stuff, it was like either you bought a Tag Heuer Monaco or a Chopard Mille Miglia, yeah. Or that yeah. was, or, you know, that was, those are the two things you had to choose from, basically. And those were both like way beyond my means at the time. So I just, that was the kernel of thought that started the whole thing, was saying, why isn't there not something like this that is for people who like design, who are car enthusiasts and they want something that's gauge inspired? And so I started working on that. I was, you know, a designer. I just, in my spare time, I started doing drawings and 3D CAD of these concepts. And then eventually I said, okay, I think I should actually make this. This thing could be really cool. And I had no idea what to expect. I just thought, okay, at worst, if it's a failure, I'll just sell eventually all the stuff that I made and I'll go back. I'll continue being a designer, basically. Yeah. And at best, you know, maybe it'll actually be a business for me. So that was kind of the way that it started.
And that was what year?
That was 2009.
Okay. Okay.
And 2011 is when we actually launched.
Okay.
In November of 2011. But it was about a two-year process from that drive through the woods to the point where I actually had a commercialized product.
Okay.
Do you still have the GTV6?
No, I sold it. Ugh. It was a bittersweet moment to sell it, honestly, because it started to need more things, and it was my only car. So I kind of needed it to be reliable. It couldn't be like, oh, it doesn't want to start today. I'll just leave it in the garage. It was like, no. If it break, and I had a thing where the engine just quit on the Hutchinson Parkway, and I managed to coast onto an exit ramp.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, I think I need a car that I have a bit more of a. I hate to say this at this point, because that car was actually really reliable. I drove it to Watkins Glen. I caned it for 2 days at the track, and I drove it home without a single issue. It's not like it was an unreliable car.
Right.
But with any car that's old, things start to go and you need to maintain them. And the car had kind of reached a point where it needed a bit more TLC than I could really justify at the time, like giving it. So
back
then, I ended up selling it.
They were 2009, 10, they were pretty cheap, actually.
They were really cheap. Yeah.
Now,
really
they're,
cheap.
They're
actually, I managed
up.
To have the only car that did not jump in value during the like classic car moment.
That's how it always works.
Thank
right?
you very much. I should have bought that. I also thought of buying a 912 at the time, but then the ones that that were in my budget at the time were such complete rusty, crappy cars. Yeah. So I'm glad I didn't buy them because they would have been trouble. But the GTV6 was awesome, and the guy who bought it, it went to a great home, and the guy repainted it, and it looks beautiful now. I still keep in touch with that guy, it's great. And it's funny too, because the car was in San Diego for most of its life. It was bought by a guy in Maine who drove it from San Diego back to Maine.
Okay, wow.
Then I bought it from him. He was like kind of a sort of a dealer. Mm-hmm. Like he bought it to resell. So it was in Maine for like probably less than a year. Then I bought it. I had it for 5 or 6 years. And then now the guy who bought it, it's back in San Diego.
Oh, no way.
Car was meant to be.
Yeah, the car just was like, I'm done with this East Coast thing. I'm going home.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, I found it very poetic that the guy that bought it actually lived only a few miles from where the car was registered before.
That's cool.
So it's kind of neat.
Is that guy an Auto Dremel customer by chance now?
I think he has some of our gloves. I don't know. I can't remember if he bought a watch or
That's
not.
That's cool,
but,
though.
But yeah.
It's cool that the car inspired the brand, and then the guy who owns the car is now connected.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So it's 2011.
Yeah.
You launch Auto Dremo.
Yeah.
How do you launch a brand? Like what I think people take for granted today that, there's micro brands and they pop up constantly.
Yeah, it was a very different time.
It was a very different time. I mean, back then.
It was a very different time.
Yeah, nobody was launching their own watch brands in, especially Americans were not launching their own watch brands in 2011.
Yeah, you hit it at a good time. And if you did launch in 2011, chances are it didn't stick around. And you're still here.
Yeah, I'm still here. Hmm. So Hodinkee was the first post ever. It was the official exclusive story. New brand alert, I remember, with a headline.
Nice.
And that day, it was like a massive amount of orders. And I thought, oh, this might actually work out. And also at the time, Uncrate was another one that it was like a juggernaut site that generated a huge amount of interest for us. And that kind of kicked the ball off rolling. And then that kind of fed into all these other sites. And that was a time, it wasn't before Instagram and it wasn't before Kickstarter, but those things were not commercially important the way they are now, to put it. I don't know how else to describe it. So in a larger sense, it was before those things, but they did exist. Like that Pebble watch. I don't know if you remember the Pebble watch.
Yeah.
Like that, I was that was before. The Pebble watch came out after Auto Dremo launched. That's how long ago. That was like the first big like major watch launch on Kickstarter, which generated over $1 million, and that was like whoa, and that was, you remember? I mean,
that was
a big deal at the time. Yeah,
it was absolutely huge.
So that was like kind of when Kickstarter, I think, became more of a thing in like starting a watch brand, but. I didn't even know it existed when I started. Same thing. I didn't have an Instagram account until like years later. So it was really about, and I didn't have a publicist either. So I was like just sending out press releases to everyone I could think of and contacting all of my favorite car magazines and saying like, hey, maybe this would be of interest to your readers because this is under $500 and it's really cool. And it's a vintage inspired, Italian inspired brand. So I think people because there was not this type of, oversaturation that we have today, editors were really interested. They were like really taking notice because this was new and it was different. So at that, we were really benefiting from the time that we launched at.
Mm. And then do you remember at what point you kind of made the decision like, okay, this is going to work. Like this is now what I'm doing full time. This is my brand. This is my job. I'm in.
Yeah. I mean, I recouped my initial investment in the first 6 months and I thought, okay, like, so now I'm kind of in the black and, I had gone down to 3 days a week at my job, which was really nice of my boss to let me do that. I mean, I took a pay cut, but I mean, it was still nice of him to let me like stay on and have the safety net of, a basic, you know, rent paying income.
Yeah.
And basically after 6 months of being on 3 days a week and having recouped the initial investment, I thought, he and I sat down and he was like, listen, I think you're going to be okay. Like, and I need someone full time. So I think it's time for you to go and like spread your wings basically. So you could say I got fired, but you could also say, you know, he kicked the bird out of the nest, and
yeah,
I think
it was
the right thing to do for both of us. And, you know, that was when I went full time on the brand. And I always tell people like, don't quit your day job. Like that's a terrible thing to do. You have to just find a way to do both things for a period of time. Mm-hmm. Because I think if I had quit my day job before starting the brand, that would have been insane.
Yeah. It's funny because it feels like such a like great romantic story. Like, oh, I quit my job. I went and did this. It worked. I believed in myself, whatever. But it's like, could have easily gone the other direction.
You got to pay the rent. Yeah. You got to have a backup plan. And
got to be practical.
Yeah. Yeah. But you got, you know, you have to work twice as hard. But that's, you know, it's just what happens.
And what year was that?
That was like 2012, I guess. So
you've been doing it full time since 2012.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then when we launched the Monoposto, that was in 2012, November of 2012.
Yeah.
That was when we kind of, the Monoposto was our first automatic watch.
Right.
And that watch really, I think, is the one that kind of made the name for us. And, and you know, it wasn't like horologically significant in any way, but it was a watch that people really took notice of. It's still our most collectible watch to this day. It's the one that people are always emailing me, like asking about, when are you going to make more of them? Or where can I find one?
Automatic watch, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Everything up until then was quartz.
Yeah, the original collection was quartz. Right. I didn't really know how much people wanted automatic watches, but again, this whole like internet culture around watches was still kind of. Obviously, there were forums for a long time, but that was really like a subculture.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as far as like a quasi mainstream interest in automatic watches, that was kind of, again, driven by sites like Hodinkee. And that interest in, you know, so it didn't occur to me to launch with an automatic movement. I just didn't think there was a demand for that in 2011. But then, you know, we started getting emails like, oh, I would love to buy this if you made something with automatic. So we moved in that direction. Now I have a much more nuanced and accomplished view of these things, but at the time I was still learning a lot, you know, so that was just kind of how it went.
And now a look at this week's sponsor. When it was first introduced in 1969, the El Primero chronograph caliber was nothing short of groundbreaking. It was the very first high-speed automatic chronograph, and it arrived during a critical time in the history of watchmaking. While a 5 Hz automatic chronograph is still plenty impressive 50 years later, Zenith has continued to innovate in the world of high-speed, high-precision timekeeping, using the El Primero as a jumping-off point for new creations. One notable evolution of the El Primero is the striking 10th. This watch has a central chronograph hand that makes one rotation of the dial every 10 seconds, with markings around the outer edge that let you measure time precisely down to 1/10 of a second. This takes the mechanical advantages foundational to the El Primero and puts them front and center. Pushing things even further is the El Primero Defy 21. This watch uses a special caliber fitted with two escapements. The first beats at 5 Hz and tells the time, and the second beats at 50 Hz and is used just for the chronograph function. This means you can measure events down to 1/100th of a second right on your wrist. The most exciting thing about all of this, though, is that 50 years after unveiling the El Primero, Zenith is far from done. As we celebrate the first 5 decades of this incredible movement, it's easy to get excited about the next 5, too. To learn more about the El Primero, visit zenith-watches.com. All right, let's get back to the show. Were you using, you know, obviously you had the inspiration from the car world itself, but were you looking at things like old dash timers and vintage Hoyers and that kind of like the sort of like historical connection between cars and watches as a place to kind of mine information or to mine kind of ideas? Or were you really trying to kind of stay away from that?
No, I was interested in mining it and in making references. I find it interesting and fun to make historical references as kind of like Easter eggs that people who know, they get it, and they know, and other people don't know, but it's okay. And so I was interested in vintage Heuer. I mean, our Prototipo chronograph obviously was very much a Heuer slash Omega slash, it was a barrel case chronograph. There were, every brand had a barrel case chronograph in like 1972. The idea was that was the prototype era of racing. So it's called the Prototipo or the Prototipo. That watch was meant to reference that time period in motorsport, and what would a driver have worn in 1972 other than a barrel cased chronograph. So that all kind of, that's the watch that kind of is the most referential to other watches that I've done. But that one, again, it did draw on historical watch references, but it also was meant to be like kind of an artifact that could have existed at the time, even though it was quartz, but it kind of, again, at that time, there weren't any other manufacturers, pretty much. I think Oris may have been the only manufacturer when we launched that was making a barrel-cased chronograph.
Interesting.
You can think now how many people have made barrel-cased watches since then that are reissues.
Yeah.
Speedmaster Mark II reissue had not been done yet. You know, again, it was something like where I was like, oh, why is nobody making this kind of cool sunburst brushed, you know, barrel case anymore? Like, that's so sweet. So that's why I did that. It was because I couldn't find a new watch that had that look to it. And again, in a certain price point. So I made it. And it was a very popular piece. And again, the Vic Elford version of that was now our kind of cult classic that we only made 224. And that's, other than the Monoposto, the most kind of sought after Autodromo watch is the Vic Elford edition Prototipo.
Yeah, you mentioned launching the Monoposto in 2012. Did you launch that at Salon QP in London?
The Monoposto?
Or
no.
Was that earlier?
The Monoposto was just sort of launched online.
Okay.
There was no. We had a little. Actually, no. We had a party at Modern Anthology in Brooklyn in Dumbo, which was my first brick and mortar retailer, and they very kindly hosted a nice little party for us. And that's where we launched the Monoposto.
Okay.
And then the Prototipo, I think we just launched online.
Okay.
Salon QP, we launched the Group B there.
Okay.
But that was later.
Okay. Because I think the first time we met was Salon QP in 2012.
2012.
Because I know the Monoposto was
out. Yeah, because the Group B,
out.
We launched the second year we were at QP. You're right.
Yeah.
The first year I was at QP, we were just representing our brand with our UK retailer, Page & Cooper. They had a booth. It was, I think, three or four brands, and we were one of those four that they, you know, we had like a multi-brand booth.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's right. We were promoting the Prototipo that year.
Okay.
But it was already out.
Okay. Because we've talked about this before, but I think it's worth bringing up now is that era is kind of right on the edge of when smaller brands were starting to launch and kind of this like connoisseur culture around not just Patek and Rolex and the big guys, but around kind of other things was starting to really ramp up. I mean, we were seeing it on the Hodinkee side and, you know, shows like Salon QP, where there was, you know, which for people who don't know is an annual consumer facing trade show in London, was kind of a really special place back then and offered a really interesting chance for brands and press and collectors to all kind of mingle and interact. And I just have very fond memories of that.
Yeah, it was just definitely a very like pre-Brexit frothy London.
Yeah, pre-Brexit.
You know, everyone was very, I just felt like it was a time in London where it just seemed like everything was like way on the upswing in a very frivolous, like, frothy way.
Yeah. And the community was so excited. Like, I just remember getting there and like the New York watch community has always, as long as I've been involved, has always been great. But I just remember getting to London with Ben and, you know, you were there and a bunch of other folks who are kind of still in the community and the industry today. I just remember getting there and being like, holy shit, like people here love this stuff too. Like this community is really global.
Yeah, we had a lot of love from the British watch collectors because they, again, I think, particularly gearheads or petrol heads, as they would like to be called in England, they really know about vintage watches as well. They collect them, I'd say more so than here. Like the average guy at that show who had a cool car. He had like vintage Hoyers at home. He had all the stuff. You know, he knew all the drivers. He grew up watching them race. So they were getting all those Easter eggs. They were immediately getting all the citations and references, and like they're like, oh, this is like speaking to me. And it was great. You know, it was probably one of the most gratifying show experiences I've ever had, of just, you know, if you have some people that actually get your work and they like really love it. And on top of that, these people are generally not price sensitive either. So they were just like, oh, you have like three colors of the Prototipo, like, how much are they? Oh, I'll just buy all three. I love these. These are great. Yeah, and they would just buy them. And it was not a big deal. And I found that I was very, very flattered and humbled by that. Because these were people that could afford, like, maybe not any watch they want, but they could afford a lot of very nice things. And the fact that they were willing to buy like a $600 quartz watch and buy three of them just because they thought it was so darn cool, that was really, to me, that's like the biggest compliment is when I get people who either own or can afford extremely fine watches that also like our stuff, because it's just fun and it checks boxes for them, and they love the design and they recognize the quality. And those are the things that for me are the biggest compliment. That, or when somebody on the other end is saving up money to buy one of our watches, is also like very humbling, that someone would save up for months to buy an Autodromo watch. It means a lot to me. And so I always want to make sure that person isn't let down either, that they're valued just as much as a customer as the guy who has tons of stuff. But those are the two extremes of our customer base. And I like to try to, as much as I can, keep both of those people happy.
So you experience some success and you're on the rise, but the GTV6 isn't in the picture. So I understand you do some vintage racing and so forth. Now your brand's on the upswing. You got to get back into cars. And that's obviously going to inform and fuel your watch design and so forth.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you do?
Well, the first car I bought, I still had the GTV6 at the time. I really wanted a Fiat Dino, actually.
Ooh, wow. Well, that ship may have sailed.
I wanted
at that
a
point.
Fiat Dino Coupe.
All right.
And I was, which are, they were actually like, they were about 20 grand at the time.
Really?
Fiat Dino Coupes, yeah. The 2400s. Anyway, I wanted one of those. I was searching on Craigslist. Again, Craigslist was a bit more of a thing back then than it is now to buy stuff. But anyway, I was searching Craigslist and I would always keep my search terms very general, because you would, you know, sometimes people misspell stuff and like you'd find like Alfa Romero, kind of stuff. And there were cool stuff that would come up. So I just searched for Dino by itself. And this Dino GT4 shows up, and it's in New Jersey, and it's black, and it's a Series 1 Euro car. And I thought, holy crap, I always wanted one of these, but I always said if I was ever going to get one, it had to be a dark color, it had to be European model, and it had to be a Series 1, and it had to be Dino badged.
Sounds perfect.
And this car was every single one of those things, and it was really reasonably priced. You know, again, those cars were really not popular or desirable at the time. And I thought the price seemed so low that I was like, I bet it's a scam, but you know what? I'll just email the guy and see what happens. You know, like, let's see, like, if it turns out to be real.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it was a real guy. He was in Montclair, New Jersey. He was an older guy. Yeah,
that's where I grew up.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, Caldwell, right around there.
You ever see a black Dino GT4 driver?
No, that's the thing. And the thing is, growing up, I did have tabs on every decent car.
Did you ever see a yellow Intermechanica Itala Spider?
No.
Okay, same guy. Right. But anyway, he had some oddball Italian cars, and he was very, very nice, and I went out and saw the car. It was great. But I remember thinking at the time, like, you know, wow, this is a Ferrari. Like, oh my God. Like,
that's like a big deal.
It's a big deal.
Huge.
Like, and it, you know, we're still talking under $20,000 here, guys. This is not like I know that's a lot of money to some people. I'm not meaning a dick. I'm just saying it was still like an affordable car in the bigger scheme of things, okay? But I was just saying, like, oh my God, like, I can't believe I'm getting into this. Like, what if this happens? What if that happens? You know, it was so intimidating to buy such a car.
Right.
And I was like, oh, I don't know if I should do this. And, you know, and thankfully, like, it all worked out. The car's actually been great and it's been reliable. And
you still have it?
Yeah, yeah, I still have it. Wow. It's been repainted since then. And
that's the car with the Autodromo license plate.
That's the Autodromo license plate, yes. Yeah. Wow. And that's in the, we did a Petrolicious video with that car. That was before the respray. That was, again, one of the early generation of Petrolicious videos. That was another site that early on, I was one of the first sponsors of that site in the day.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
It was me and Haggerty were the first advertisers.
Not bad company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a really great love affair with that car. And unfortunately, this gentleman that sold it to me has since passed away, but he was very kind. And you know, he let me have the car, even though he had other offers. But he, you know, right. I came first to see it and came in person. And
he probably recognized just struck the it off.
Yeah, he saw that I was really passionate about it. And it's been awesome.
I just love that you bought a Ferrari on Craigslist.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's awesome. That is so cool.
Yeah. I'm sure there's still Ferraris on Craigslist.
I'm sure. Now, yeah. But, I just love that. I love the idea of perusing Craigslist. Totally. And you find a Ferrari.
Well, I always like to deal locally if I can.
Yeah.
I think you can get into deep trouble buying cars sight unseen on the internet. And even if the photos look good, you know, it's just so risky.
So you're not on Bring a Trailer every night then?
No, I look at Bring a Trailer, okay. But it's,
yeah,
I have been on a few things, but that's another thing is that, you know, dealing locally or dealing with a private seller, you don't have to compete against, some super rich guy who's like, I'm going to buy that $16,000 car before breakfast just because I can, you know?
Right.
And then they sell it like 4 months later when they've had their fun with it. That's a big problem on Bring a Trailer is that you have a certain audience of people that are like, really rich and they just buy stuff on a whim. And then there's a lot of other people that are like, I would really have liked to have had that car.
Yeah.
But you know, it's hard to outbid people that have unlimited resources. So it's a bit of a challenge. I mean, sometimes you see stuff sell for really great prices there, but unfortunately nothing I've ever bid on is sold for a really great price.
Yeah. that same thing's actually kind of happening in the watch world too. Now that the knowledge is out there and the knowledge is starting to accumulate in one place, it's hard to find those deals. It's hard to find
It is harder deals. To find them. You have to, that's why it's more gratifying when you really, I always jokingly say to my friends in the auction business, I'm like, yeah, I bought the car. You know, the way people used to buy cars, they actually knew the guy and they like went and saw it and they exchanged photos and they talked about it and then they made a deal and they handshake, you know, like that whole romance of buying a car face to face with someone is a bit rarer today. It still happens, but, I try to do that when I can, because you do end up generally, at least you're not in a competitive process.
Yeah. Do you also enjoy that process or is it just about kind of having the easiest transaction experience?
No, I like that process. It's harder when you're selling something. I mean, I think when you're the seller, you want to have a wider audience to see what you're selling and so on and so forth. But you know, when I sold the GTV6, it was through the Alpha Bulletin Board and it was a local guy who lived in Dumbo. He came to see the car I had it in a parking garage in Dumbo at the time and he came over and saw it and we took it out and drove it. And, you know, it was the old way and it was great. And I had an Alpha Montreal at one point and I sold through Hemmings. But again, it was the sort of the old school way where you put an ad and guy comes and sees it. It wasn't an auction site or anything. So that was a good experience. And he actually did, he has bought a watch, that guy.
Nice. Good.
To answer your previous question. Good. That guy is a big fan of the brand now.
Perfect. Cole touched on it, but I want to make sure we don't let it slip. You actually race vintage cars too. You're not just a guy who kind of like takes it out cruising on the weekends.
Yeah, I would love to do more racing. It's very time consuming and expensive, but I about five race weekends a year. I have a 59 Giulietta Spider Veloce race car.
Which is super beautiful.
Yeah. And I've taken it on the Copper State 1000 twice. So it's done 2,000 mile rallies in Arizona. And
for people who don't know, that car is open top.
Yeah. There is no top. The top has been removed from the car. There's no windshield frame. So there's no need for a top, because it has a plastic windscreen that's cut down. And my wife, who's an amazing person, comes with me on these rallies, and we put on, for not for style, but we actually wear vintage sort of polo helmet style helmets because they keep your head dry and they keep the wind from buffeting your ears and they keep the sun off the back of your neck. And they actually do a great job of keeping you comfortable. And so, yeah, we've done that rally twice. And then I do, you know, I mainly race at Lime Rock, and I do a couple other, I try to do one long distance event every year. So one year we went to Pittsburgh for the Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix, which is amazing. One year I took it to Mosport, which is where the Canadian Grand Prix used to be held back in the day, and Can-Am races in Ontario. And then we also did Mont-Tremblant, which is in Quebec. That was great. So I try to do like once a year, I'll like bring the car to somewhere a bit further away. I have not yet done any West Coast though. So that someday,
coming soon.
Well, maybe not soon, but I would love to do the Monterey Historics one day. That would be a really amazing event. And I know people have done it and they say it's awesome. I did with a friend in his car, we did a race down at Sebring, which was super cool. And it was my first time racing at night, which was cool. Awesome. And, just to be at Sebring at night, the atmosphere is just incredible. And it just, you really feel like the sense of history of the place. And, the way the headlights shake over all those terrible bumps that they have all over the place, it looks just like you could be back in the day, you know, the 1960s, and it's just really, really cool place.
That's awesome. One thing I'll come clean about, right, is I am not a car guy. Okay. Like not at all. I know enough that
Steven,
I can.
So, Steven, should we tell the story about how you declined to learn how to drive manual on a certain vehicle?
Yeah. We won't say whose car it is, but someone I know offered to teach me not just to drive manual, but to drive. I've had my driver's license for a year.
Wait,
okay.
Is that true?
Yeah, I got my driver's license a year ago.
He's the only
Texan
that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm also I'm from Texas. I'm not like a city kid. Yeah, yeah. I had somebody offer to like full on teach me to drive
in a 1960s V12 Ferrari. We'll leave it at that.
Okay.
I was thinking of how specific to be, but yeah, we'll leave it at that.
Actually, I probably would turn that down too.
Yeah, exactly. He was very generous.
It is very intimidating.
I don't need to be responsible for wrapping this around a tree. Yeah. Also, we'll both die if I wrap this around a tree.
Did it have a gated shifter?
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
All right. Cool. This shows you how big of a car guy I am. But the reason I set myself up like that is I actually, despite not being a car guy, have always really connected with Autodromos products for whatever reason.
You're a design guy.
Yeah, and I think it is, I think, because I'm a design guy. And I think the thing that makes the product so compelling to me is that while, like you said, if you're a car guy, you get all these little Easter eggs. I feel that way about being a sort of like design person looking at these products is the sort of attention to detail and the way everything is considered and balanced and the way that colors play with one another and the finishing. These are very clearly not products designed by committees who are worried about like maximizing efficiencies and maximizing, you know, well, if we make the bezel this way, we can make 0.5% more profit on each watch versus if we make the bezel this way, we'll make 0.5% less profit on each watch, but the product will be better.
Yeah, that's certainly not true. It's certainly true in my case that often the product is more expensive because of the... the one great, great thing about running my own company is that I don't have to answer to any bean counters about this little extra thing I want to do is going to cost X dollars more. It's like, if I think it's going to make the product, I just do it. And of course, sometimes that actually does really hurt the bottom line because sometimes people like they compare our products to, let's say, other automotive inspired watches in our general price range. And they say, well, Autodrome was more expensive than X brand. And the reason for that is not like that I'm greedy. It's that there's a lot of stuff that I do that is actually pretty expensive to make, like the folded aluminum boxes for the Group B, which that's a pretty expensive box, frankly, to make. And there's other stuff like that, whether it's a feature of the watch or a feature of the packaging that I just felt like it was necessary for the product, and I really, really wanted to do it a certain way. And I have to charge more to make a profit on it. And the customers that I have, you know, appreciate those things. So that gentleman, ladies and gentlemen, is why our products are a lot more expensive sometimes than competitor brands that are kind of, you know, aping what we're doing. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, cool. We're starting to get the sign from the booth that we have to start wrapping things up. So yeah. I think we're going to transition to the Hodinkee questionnaire, and then we'll do some cultural recommendations at the end and get out of here. So I've got a couple of quick fire questions for you, Bradley.
Oh God, quick fire questions.
Yeah. Sorry, man. The first one is what's a watch that's caught your eye recently?
Well, it's not really a watch, but something that caught me by surprise.
I'll let you cheat
here. It was a clock, actually. It was a dash clock, but
fair.
Out of a car I did not expect to be impressed with. And it was just there was a guy with a first generation Japanese market Supra at a car show I went to recently. And the dash clock was totally sick. It was really, really minimal. And it was just like a black dial with like just an orange hand. But the proportions of it, it just looks so good. I was like, oh, I had no idea this car had a cool dash clock. I always felt like the interior on those cars was kind of whatever, just 90s blah kind of design. But it was very cool. So Supra dash clock.
That counts. That's a unique answer, but we'll count.
Yeah, I wish I had a better answer for you. I wish I could give you something that would make all of your audience go,
But I think that's a good answer.
Yeah, totally.
All right, next question. What's the best place you've traveled in the last year?
In the last year? I recently went to Bermuda.
Oh, nice.
And we went there for a baby moon because it's actually only an hour. It's an amazingly close place. It's an hour and a half flight.
That's
from New York. You'd think it's like, you know, hours away. And it is really remote. It's basically across from North Carolina, though, if you look at it kind of on a map.
Huh. Never thought about it.
And I can't think of a more foreign, unusual place to go in such a short amount of time that it just feels like you're very far away and like the cars are right-hand drive and the roads are really narrow and
accents.
It's very, very, yeah, the accent's different and it is a foreign country, you know? So I can't say it was like a cultural voyage going there. I mean, it's still a resort place and I've been to much more quote interesting places, but I think it was really eye-opening. Also how old everything is there. Mm-hmm. It actually has, you know, been inhabited for a very long time relative to the quote New World. And so there is a ton of history there and it's very interesting history and, you know, with pirates and everything. And
sweet.
Yeah. It's a cool place.
Nice.
Yeah. It was definitely way more interesting. I thought it was just going to be a bit more, I'm not a beach destination guy. So
okay.
We just went there because, you know, baby moon, let's just sit on a beach and do nothing. And there's no Zika virus there, which you have to think about when your wife is pregnant. So it was a really interesting place.
Nice.
Yeah.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given and who gave it to you?
The best piece of advice I ever received was from a designer named Karim Rashid.
Okay.
And I worked as an intern for him when I was in college. And he was, at the time, like a big hero of mine. You know, I was like kind of a design nerd in 1998 and 1999, and he was really doing a lot of interesting stuff at the time. And he's a very controversial figure. Some people love him, some people hate him.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was a big fan at the time. Basically him and I was a big Mark Newson fan as well. They were both kind of super famous at the same moment for slightly different reasons, but
yeah.
They both had, you know, their monograph and all that stuff. Anyway, so I worked for Karim in New York. And at the end of my internship, he sat me down and talked to me for a while. And he said, you know, what do you want to do with your life, basically? And I said, well, I really want to be a furniture designer. I want to start my own studio. And he said, oh, Bradley, like, you got to work for someone for like 10 years, man. You can't just go out like right out of college and start your own company like that. Like you got to learn like lots of stuff. And he said, and eventually you're going to have your studio, but like go work for someone for like 10 years. And I was kind of disheartened by that at the time.
Yeah.
But he was 100% right. And I always say that to people, like college students I meet, that like are like brimming with enthusiasm and can-do attitude and want to be very entrepreneurial, which I think is awesome. And, you know, I respect that. And of course, I've, you know, all for entrepreneurship. But it's true that when you graduate from any kind of training, it's the beginning of your path of learning and knowledge, not the end. And he explained that to me basically very succinctly. And he was right. If I had started a design studio as a 24-year-old, I would have failed, definitely. And I certainly didn't have the idea to start a watch brand then. But my point is, I learned so much in the intervening 10 years of working in a studio environment that put to shame anything I learned in design school.
Great. Last question. What is your guilty pleasure?
Buick Grand National.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, man. Couldn't have answered that better.
Yeah. Among other things, but that's a pretty good one, I think.
Perfect. All right. Let's wrap things up. Cultural recommendations. What do you think, Bradley, is something that people should go check out when they're done listening to the show? It can be basically anything.
Go on YouTube and listen to David Lynch talk about The Eye of the Duck.
The Eye of the Duck.
Yeah. I think David Lynch explains this aesthetic thing. He calls it the Eye of the Duck, okay? And how much time do we have?
You got a little time.
Oh, okay.
A minute, 2 minutes?
I'll give it a quick summary. I think the Eye of the Duck is basically the key to understanding proportion and design. And he kind of talks about it in terms of cinema, but the same is true of any aesthetic pursuit or any kind of creative pursuit. And basically, he's talking about the duck has this eye that's like a jewel, right? And if you move the eye to the tip of the beak, there's all this shininess at the tip of the beak, and it's kind of like too much going on, and it's too much what he calls fastness going on. And if you moved the eye down to the body of the duck, it'd be lost in all the feathers, and it'd be kind of insignificant and meaningless. But the way it's placed exactly at the sort of bulging of the head of the duck, it just perfectly sets off the whole thing, and the duck becomes
like duck.
This thing that's a duck, and it looks right. And I think that when you look at a piece of art or architecture or anything like that, and you know it's good instinctively, it's because it has the eye of a duck. And like Mies van der Rohe put it, like he said, an interesting plainness is the most difficult and delicate thing to achieve. And I think he was talking about the exact same thing. An interesting plainness is the eye of the duck. So, you know, that's what separates like good modernism from like terrible modernism.
Yeah.
And why, you know, it's detailing and proportion and also just that little thing that just sets it off just a certain way.
I now know exactly what I'm doing when this episode's over.
same.
And so, yeah, so when I watched that, it's like some interview he did in the 90s or 80s. And
okay.
When I watched that interview, it just blew me away because I just thought, this guy like totally gets it. This is exactly, he's put into words something I instinctively felt but never could quite explain. And it's also what kind of separates, I think, professional designers from general people is having the instinctive sense of how to create that effect or how to like bring that to something that you're doing as opposed to just making something that's generally pleasant or nice or whatever you want to call it. So, go check that out. I'm sure you can find the right keywords to put in for that. But
perfect.
It's a good interview.
Cool. How about you?
We don't have much time, so I'll just say go find the trailer for Ford versus Ferrari.
Oh, yeah.
That's an appropriate one. Yeah,
I watched that.
And as a bit of a patriot and a Ford guy, I think...
I'm excited about it.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. And it's a huge moment in automotive history. And they couldn't have picked better cast, you know?
Yeah, and if you want to wear a really cool Ford-themed watch to go see that movie, we make the official watches for the Ford GT, which are available on our website.
All right. Link it up.
No plug there.
Nah, we'll link it up.
Yeah.
You're allowed to plug.
I mean, I was excited when they announced that because I was like, oh, this is perfect.
Yeah.
So,
and it looks like it's going to be awesome.
It's going to be great.
Yeah.
It's funny that I've seen like Anorak people like already nitpicking about like what brand of tires are on the car.
And I'm
like,
matter.
That's what Anorak people are
I
for.
I think that yeah. Matt Damon not looking like Carol Shelby is a much bigger thing to kind of nitpick about.
Maybe,
but,
yeah.
But, you know, I think he'll be awesome. Yeah, I'm not worried about it. But, yeah, he doesn't look remotely like Carol Shelby. But
that's fine.
That's okay.
It's really just it's capturing okay. the essence of the story, right?
Yeah.
Yes, that's my culture recommendation.
Sweet. I'm going to recommend a photography show that's opening in New York the day after we record this. This photographer, Gail Haliban, who's amazing. This is her first show in New York City, first public show in New York City. It's a mix of her work, but she really has become known for these large format photos she does shooting out of windows in cities, kind of almost voyeuristically looking into other windows. They're shot kind of wide angle.
Really cool.
Some of them are partially staged. Some of them are totally just like, it's not photojournalism, but they're real,
candid,
I guess,
yeah.
candid. They have this sort of like haunting cinematic quality to them. A friend got her book about Paris maybe 2 years ago, and since then I have not been able to stop thinking about this work. So I'm hoping to go to the opening tomorrow night.
Wow.
It's really impactful, and it's a very simple idea. It's the kind of photography that you think sort of like anybody could do just looking out their bedroom window. And it has this just really powerful kind of human element to it that I find extremely captivating. So we'll link up the exhibition, and for people who can't see it, we'll link up the book too.
Yeah,
sounds great.
I highly, highly recommend it. So awesome. Well, thank you guys. This was fun. Thanks, Bradley. Yeah. I know we've been trying to make this happen for a while. So
it's really a pleasure. I'm really thrilled to be on here, and I thank you for inviting me.
This week's episode was recorded at Miratone Studios in New York City and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.